Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. Hey, once again, my name is John, and I am joined by the ever-amazing JP. How are you doing, JP?
Good. Just a little sick, but nothing like a nice cold on Labor Day weekend.
Yeah, Labor Day weekend. It's funny. So I think most people are out enjoying barbecue and four-day weekends, and I've been coding all weekend, which is good and bad. How about you, JP?
Yeah, I thought Labor Day meant like you're supposed to be doing labor, because that's definitely what I've been
doing. That's definitely what I've been doing. Cool. Yeah, I just have so many projects going right now. It's actually been so nice this weekend just because I don't have any clients bugging me. I don't have a lot of contractors bugging me. I've just been able to like really go deep on some stuff and get a lot of traction on some projects, which is really cool.
Yeah, you had told me like offline that you were interviewing some people. Am I allowed to talk about that?
Yeah, by this time this airs, I should have used this as a strategy, but by this time this airs, I hope to have someone landed. But yeah, I'm slowly growing the firm, Better Development. withbetter.com if you want to check out what we do. But yeah, we're a little remote Rails shop and slowly growing the team, which is exciting. So I've been doing interviews this week, and it's always just exciting to meet people in the community out there. Where I'm currently hiring for a junior role, so it's really cool to just kind of hear what everybody's learning, what the new technologies are, what the boot camps are teaching, stuff like that. It's just been a really cool experience. And it's funny because people interviewing, I know they get nervous, of course, like it's a job interview, and like even if I try to be informal and chill about it, like people still get nervous over it. But I don't think people realize that the interviewers get nervous too. Like, we want it to go well and for you to be comfortable and not for it to be like a big deal. It's just really funny, that experience. But yeah, I try to make it fun and just kind of talk about tech and learn about people. And it's been pretty enjoyable. It's super time consuming, which is hard when I have a lot of projects that are behind. So it's like such a catch-22. Like, I need people, but I have to go through this long interview process to find people. And it's like, at the time, I'm just getting more and more behind. Gosh.
That's pretty crazy. Yeah. I think the interviewee gets nervous too. Sometimes I'm like, I just try to take a deep breath when I was interviewing, you know, months ago or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
And like, you can see sometimes if you just like pay attention, you know, like you could tell that they're nervous too sometimes, like, you know, a little shaky in the voice, a little shaky in the hands, you know, like not every, you know, we're all human. We're all just trying to get by.
Well, and it's an awkward social interaction because there's strange power dynamics at play. You don't know who they are. They don't know who you are. And it's like, you're just randomly, at least for mine, they're all remote. So just randomly popping into a web chat with someone. And it's just like, there's a lot of nuance there. And it's tough. You know, you don't have body language and things like that. So, you know, it's a hard thing to do well. And I hope that I'm doing a decent job. I think I've gotten better as I've done more of them, I hope so.
That's cool. So like, you have a posting out for like, obviously it's Rails and probably a little bit of JavaScript, but do you have anyone that applies that does like neither of those things and is like, I want to do this job still?
Yeah, a couple, definitely a few that, so there was like this little like matrix box that just like had you self-assess yourself in a few skills categories. So it was like JavaScript, Rails, I think it was something like other JavaScript frameworks, design. And it was surprising that there was quite a few people. We got over 200 applicants in less than 48 hours. I turned it off, which is awesome to have so many people out there who want to work remote like that. But, you know, there was a couple people, probably like four or five, who just put like learning, 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 learning in every single category, but then also put their minimum salary requirements as like 35 an hour. And I'm just like, out of a scale of 1 to 4, you're a 1 in every category and still want 35 an hour. It's like, I really want to pay people well and I want to hire juniors, but maybe that's a little too much money for a little too junior. I don't know.
Yeah, totally. You know, and this is opening up a whole another can of worms of discussion, but I think the way that things are marketed towards people who are just learning in boot camps is like, you know, I've seen so many ads from like App Academy. Maybe I shouldn't be naming these things.
Yeah, App Academy is the worst one. I'll name them hard. I saw an ad for App Academy that said, want to work at Google? Land a job now. Join our 12-week app programming course.
Yeah, and it's like minimum salary or average salary of an App Academy grad is like
$104,000. It's just like, oh.
They're very good at marketing.
Yeah, it's over-promising, I think. And at the same time, like, I want more juniors. I want more people to learn to code. There's so much demand. Like, there's so much that needs to be built and supported out there. And so don't be discouraged that you shouldn't learn to code, but also don't expect to get a job at Google after 12 weeks of learning. Like, This shit takes years to become an expert.
Yeah, it's like 3 months.
Yeah, but you can get proficient in 3 months. Like, you can ship something, sure. You could probably get a job. Maybe not making $100,000. Maybe not at Google. Anyway, great small talk this week, but I really want to dig into this material because we have some awesome stuff from this week's book. So we're still going through the book, which is Growing Rails, which has been, we started it last week. It's all about growing and scaling web applications and making the whole system manageable. And so we're jumping into the next section of this book, which is creating a system for growth. Do you want to kind of start us off in that section, JP?
Yeah, certainly. So where we left off last week, we had just talked about making our controllers nice and skinny. And we had some crazy, crazy, almost like controversially skinny controllers. But the way we did that was we moved code around. You know, honestly, the theme of this book is like moving code around and organizing. It's not about writing fewer lines of code or writing less code. It's just like, how can I organize things to make it so that it doesn't suck when I need to make changes?
And in fact, many times it's more code.
Yeah.
Like, because tearing something out, which we'll discover today, tearing something out into another module, like, takes that setup code to do so. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's actually a little bit more code, but it's all about tearing out those dependencies and making things simpler. So yeah, last week was all a lot about controllers and dealing with those. And this week, really, we start things off with the idea of a fat model. Because if you make your controller so skinny, you end up with a model that's really, really fat. Because as we learned in last week and through this book, like, the code has to go somewhere. It's gonna be somewhere if you need the functionality. Yeah,
we left off on a cliffhanger because the authors were like, but wait, aren't callbacks and models bad? Because we just threw everything into our models, basically. So that's pretty much what we're going to be addressing. I feel like there's so many terms for the same thing, like objects, service objects, poros. But like, really, all it is just like more classes, more code, more objects. That's how I think of it.
I think more objects, yeah, is more a good objects way to think about it. At least in an object-oriented system, which is generally what we're addressing. And so the first thing that I really liked about this chapter is it talks about why models grow. Like, why do they get fat? How does a model get fat? And I think the first thing is if your controller is so skinny that it only has those base actions like we were talking about last week, then some of that code, like to send an email or to confirm a user or to do validations, needs to go somewhere. So it ends up in the model. Which, some of that's okay, and it's not bad. But then what happens is the use of a model and its feature set grows over time. And it gave this example of a user model, which is always a really big god object in so many places. I feel like there's the user model that's this big giant object, and then one other in every system I touch. It'll be like the order object or the whatever that main object is that the system interacts with. I think on WizTutor, it's that tutoring session object is this giant god object, that and user. But so it's talking about how the uses of a specific model changes over time. And it gives the example of a user. So in the beginning, you can just create, read, update, and destroy a user. It's really straightforward. But then you add features like password recovery, Facebook or OAuth login, the ability for a user to edit only certain parts of their own profile, the ability for an admin to edit a user's profile with different permissions there, and then other models that interact with users or background tasks and processes. And so all of this code ends up as methods or callbacks, all living within your user object. And so over time, it grows more and more and more. And I think even last week we talked about, I think it was at some point, we talked about how in a lot of my systems, I'll have user.sendSMS, and then you can pass a string into it and it'll send an SMS to a user. That probably shouldn't live on the user. And so that's another example of something that has grown over time in functionality associated with a model. And that's how it's getting nice and big and fat and plump. And there's a quote from the book that I really liked. And so it says, quote, when you need to implement password recovery and do not have a clear single place to put the logic, it will still find a way into your code. It will spread itself across existing classes, usually making those classes harder to read and use. And so that's just kind of addressing this whole idea that a single model or object grows over time because you're expanding functionality, but not extracting other objects, which is really the nut of this section.
Yeah, let's like talk through one of these use cases like password recovery. Like, let's pretend we're not using Devise, because Devise obviously handles this very well. You don't even have to worry about anything. But, you know, like, I'm just thinking of like what would you know, what would be my like knee-jerk reaction to like implementing something like this? If I just had to like ship something super quick, didn't care about like what the design of the software actually was, I'm starting to think like, where would I put that? And yeah, it would probably go in the user model. Like open up user RB, throw some code in there to handle this password recovery. That's probably going to have, but think about how much crap that has. That has to have like, you're going to be hashing things, you're going to be salting things, you're going to be sending emails, maybe you're sending text messages. Like all that stuff is just going to like bloat your user model just for something like a password recovery. However, that is like a missing class. That is a class, its own class waiting to happen, like user password recovery.
Yeah. So like literally, you know, root domain slash user slash one slash password recovery slash new. So it's just a straight up object that you're creating, which is a password recovery object. I mean, that's one way. There's a lot of different ways you could approach that. But the idea is that you don't have that code live within your user's model or object. You extract that into some type of a password recovery object or a new password object. Maybe there's a password object that you could use, and maybe that's the right naming convention, or authentication, you know, authentication.new. And so you're able to extract all that validation, all of that specific interaction logic out of your user model, not make it as fat. Because even the way that you're saying how you would address it in the user, I feel like, you know, it'd be easy to feel like, oh, well, I could just have a before update filter that checks if password has changed. And then if the password has changed on that callback, then do this specific code specific to that interaction. And it's like, well, then you're just really mucking up your user object with this callback checking for a password change. When 99% of the time you're accessing the user model, you don't need that code. So it's a terrible place for that code.
Yeah. One thing that they had mentioned in the book is like, don't actively look for another active record class. Like, just make another class, you know? Just throw another file into your models. It doesn't have to be, like, generated from the Rails, like, Rails G.
Yeah. I really liked the what they were saying about that, that it doesn't have to necessarily map to your database. And I think this is, I'm seeing this more and more, having more and more controllers that don't directly map one-to-one to a database object, controllers and models that do so. And it's just so beneficial to begin breaking that stuff out into its own things. And they even go through this whole concept of, for it, they continue on the path of using a user object because it's a really good object that needs to be broken up. And they have, you know, they recommend creating classes and objects that inherit from the user, but they're distinct to a specific interaction. And so, you know, for example, like a user onboarding, this is actually something that I'm working on for a client right now. We're reworking the user onboarding, tearing it all out of the user model, following a convention very similar to this. And, you know, they recommend a class of user as signup, and they have this convention of as something else. And so you can still interact with the base active record object of user, but you're using it through this interaction specific model, which is so convenient because you get different validations, you get different methods on it, you have different callbacks on it that are specific to that interaction, if that's something you need. And it makes a ton of sense when you start thinking of it, because then instead of a user's new that you're routing to, you're a signup new, or a user, a signup as user, you know, you're a user as signup new controller. And then from there, you can have the welcome email sent and have the callback where it belongs within that signup model versus totally mucking up your user model.
Yeah. So they talk about like these two different concepts of different types of models. So they have things what they call your like your core models, and they have things called interaction specific form models. Now, this is just like a very fancy way of saying like your active record models and your non-active record models. So your core models are your basic active record models. And so they say that the only things you should have in your active record models are sets of validations to enforce integrity. So, you know, like your validates, presence of, length, maximum, whatever, you know, just to have some like column validation integrity. And then associations, you know, like your has many and your belongs to, those types of things. And universally useful convenience methods to find or manipulate records. So like, let's say you have to do like a complex join with user on appointments. And then, you know, just throw that there into a scope. And then you're able to call like user dot appointments on Thursday or something like that.
Right.
But that's all your core model should have. Now, that's very intense. But I kind of jive with that. Like, I think that's like a pretty solid approach, because I think you can make a case for anything else belonging in other things. So that was core models. Now we have interaction specific form models, which aren't your active record models. And so what they say is these should have the virtual attributes that don't map one-to-one with your database. That makes sense. Callbacks to fire for a particular screen. Let's say, you know, form signups, password recoveries, things like that. So like, you want the perks of active record models without active record. And so like, that's what we're getting into talking about, like inheritance of like user as signup or whatever.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. And that was a good explanation of like exactly what should belong on which types of these models. And just to go 20,000 foot here for a second. So we're specifically using Rails as an example of this, but this could apply to almost any object-oriented web development infrastructure. In some ways, some of this could even be extracted in a functional approach in some ways. So go there with us for a second. But the idea here is, specifically with an object-oriented, I will say, actually, you have a model that's gotten fat and it's handling a lot of dependencies for other things. The nut of what we're saying is, just because you have that model that maps to the database doesn't mean you only have to interact with the model that way. Just create a new model, create a new class that handles this interaction-specific code. And if it's convenient and if it works well, you can even have that inherit from the base object and make those very specific to each of the interactions that they're doing, so that you have more models and ultimately the same amount of code, but it's split into the discrete functionality that makes a ton of sense. So instead of your user object handling signup and password recovery, you have a password recovery model or a signup model that's handling those specific interactions, and all those action specific views and interactions can be done. So we talked about last time having, you know, controllers that don't map to one-to-one with other controllers, spinning out other controllers. And this is just pushing that even further to having other models that map to those controllers that aren't necessarily mapped directly to database-backed objects.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting that this is like very different than single table inheritance, which is like what we use in WizTutor, I realized, because you have like a user folder, and that user folder has a tutor object, a student object, a coordinator object, and those all...
That all inherit from the user
object. Right, so like, yeah. If you wanted to create like, if you wanted to do like tutor.new, you could, or like student.new. So this is like totally different than single table inheritance. This is more of just like having classes that inherit from your active record model that share functionality with the active record model, but don't necessarily need to be there, I think.
Yeah, I think single table inheritance is something similar,
sure,
though.
Sure.
In a lot of ways, it's accomplishing some of the same goals, but you're right that it's not directly the same thing. And it doesn't always have to be, because in that case, like, it's pretty much the same type of object that you're expecting back, where in these cases, we're extracting something totally different out of it that's specific to an interaction. So in the case of WizTutor, it would make a lot of sense to have a coordinator as signup model versus just a coordinator model that inherits from user. But the coordinator as signup model would inherit from coordinator, which inherits from user. So ultimately, it still would be leveraging the single table inheritance. And to me, that would make a ton of sense to refactor that signup model. Because right now, there's this like very janky build controller within the tutor's signup. It's like its own custom action that manages that onboarding. It's a total cluster. And I think this would be a wonderful way to refactor that. It would make a ton of sense.
One day we should just like step through the WizTutor code base and like refactor it on live. Just got, I don't know.
Live refactor. No, it'd be great. At least to just like point out, I feel like that code base, even though it's running and making money and in the world, and that's a lesson in itself, that it's like out there working, pretty performant actually. But you know, I built that probably 3.5 years ago. The first version's 3 years ago, give or take. And I made probably every mistake that you shouldn't make in that code base. Like every single one, from fat controllers to, you know, methods that are too long, they're all there. So it'd be a great one to kind of step through as some bad examples. I wanted to actually like start a Twitter thing, which is like embarrassing code snippets and like hashtag, yes, I wrote this. And just like, you know, tweet out really bad code and have people kind of talk about it and refactor it just with the hashtag, yes, I wrote this. It'd be a good trend of just that whole thing.
Yeah, I feel like that has a lot of potential to get some like big names in the space to like maybe post snippets of their like projects or whatever. That'd be cool.
Some embarrassing code. Yeah, I'd love to see like a DHH or someone like that. It's like, here's a shitty method I wrote at some point. It'd be
you
awesome.
You have to scroll to see the whole thing.
Yeah, for sure. So the next big section that it jumps into is outside of these interaction-specific models, which is basically form objects. If you want to Google something, that's what we've been talking about the whole time there. So the next one is, drumroll, service objects, which we talk about way, way, way too much.
They're just objects.
Do you want to give...
Yeah.
Yeah, they're just objects. Do you want to give us a little reminder of service objects, JP? You want to give us a start in
that? So the way that they... Because I've read so many different things about service objects, and people have very different opinions on what they should be doing. But the way that the authors describe of like when you know you'll have a service object. Okay, and at the end of the day, you're basically treating it the same as you would any other refactor that they're talking about, because it's basically just like taking it out of the core model and putting it into its own. You don't have to put it into like a services folder. It could be in the models folder. It's just a service object. But their clear indication that you need to be doing this is if you're calling class methods on the user. So if you're calling like user.find by location or something like that, I don't know. Maybe you can do like a user location service, something like that. In the past, I've used them if I'm interfacing with external APIs. So like if I was interfacing with like the Twitter API to grab tweets, I would then make a Twitter service, like a Twitter fetcher service or something like that. Or if I'm like interfacing with the Twilio API, I would make like an SMS service or something like that. So now those are two kind of different things, because I'm not necessarily calling class methods against a core model. But to me, they both make sense. I think both are service objects. They're like executing a type of service. I don't know. The more I talk about service objects, the more I don't want to talk about service objects, because they're just objects. They're just objects that have their own specific interaction or own specific action that they need to execute that doesn't have anything to do with like a core domain or a core model.
Yeah, I would agree. I think this book pushes it further than I've ever taken it, which is the book is pretty much adamant that you should never call a dot anything, at least in Rails. So, you know, if you're thinking about your top level object, whether it's a user or an order, they're essentially saying you should never really use a method on a class in itself. That just shouldn't belong there. You know, I have a service that I use. So I work in this health coaching platform. And so within this health coaching platform, each participant has things like goals they're accomplishing for the day. So it's like, did you go on a run today? Did you eat healthy today? And they're kind of rating themselves on a score of 1 through 5. And so for a long time within that user object, there was like user.score for today, user.score for this week. And there was all of these methods that had these really complex joins that checked which day it was, checked within 24 hours, added up their scores and returned their scores. And that was primed to be extracted into this user stat service. So it's like user stat service.new, you pass it the user, and then you call methods on the user stat service. And it extracted all of this code and logic that was just really mucking up the main model of user into its own service. And so I think to me, that's a perfect example of something that's really good to extract. And yeah, of course, like you said, API endpoints. But I like the idea of what this book is saying, which is basically anytime you're calling any kind of function, any kind of method, on a model, you should be pulling that out into its own service, which makes a lot of sense. But then again, sometimes accessing these, it's just like you're instantiating this service object and then calling on the service object when you could just be calling it on the object. So I think there's a balance to be struck here sometimes. And the only thing that's hard for me is like where sometimes, and I know we have view helpers and decorators, but sometimes accessing relevant records and fields is really just convenient to stick them on the model. And so I struggle that with sometimes, especially when you have an association, like for example, user.appointment.startTime, and you want to access like the next user's appointment start time, but they may or may not have an appointment. And so doing all that logic in the view doesn't always make sense to me either. So I don't know. Sometimes it makes sense.
I think that's fine. I think what you're talking about is like scopes. Like I think that'd be totally within the bounds of their rules for core models is like if I want like user.appointments.first or whatever, like you can just like have that as a method in a scope called
like first appointment.
Yeah. And then you could call like the instance of user.firstappointment.
Right. Okay.
So I think you're saying the same thing differently.
Yeah, so that's, you're saying that's within the scope that they're encouraging, which is these kind of main convenience methods and scopes. That's all good to go. They're good with that. It's really when we're talking about things like these more complex calculations and methods against an object that are really mucking things up. Just pull them out. Stick them in a service.
Yeah, it's like if you wrote like a class method called send email for whatever reason. Now, obviously, that's very contrived. But if you had like def self.sendEmail in your user model, and then to invoke it, you would call like capital U user.sendEmail. It had to be very explicit over over like audio recording. But like if you called like user.sendEmail, that's like when they're saying like, hey, you shouldn't really be doing that, because that's not really specific to an instance of a user. That's more of like the user class itself. So when you find yourself not calling methods against instances or passing messages from instances of your class, then, you know, maybe that deserves its own service.
Got it. So it's when it doesn't have an instance called of the object is when it's really starting to be dangerous. That makes a ton of sense.
Yes.
So the next subject is honestly way too exciting to me, and I've got way too much benefit from it, and I'm a total nerd, but organizing large code bases with namespaces. So the idea here is not really changing any of your code beyond having an organizational system against your code base. So having an approach to nest things within folders and a system of inheritance that just makes sense to manage a project. And so when some of the projects that I have managed, a main one that I'm thinking of is this health coaching platform. We had so many models. I mean, 30, 40 plus models in our main directory. And so you open the models and it's just really overwhelming to just get started and understand what's going on and know where you should go and what to do first. And so the real takeaway here is just to begin to structure those within a hierarchy. So not only your controllers, but your models, your tests, everything within a hierarchy that makes sense. So the first example they gave, which is a great example, is an invoice with items. And so you picture like an invoice, you owe money. An invoice has a list of different items that are owed. So, you know, here's invoice for Acme Incorporated, and item one is a hammer, item two is a nail. So it's an invoice with items. And so in the initial example, you have both an invoice.rb and then you have an item.rb. And when you're just looking at those two in a models folder, you don't necessarily see their association right away or understand that they're connected or should be like in your brain in the domain. They're connected together. And so what it recommends is creating a new invoice folder directory within your models, placing the item within it. And then so then it's really clear that this item object belongs to and interacts to the invoice object. And doing this with as many of the has many and belongs to associations you can. And so for us in the health coaching platform, and we went from these 40 plus just flat items in this flat structure within models, controllers, and tests to like a nice clean five folders that have all the associations within them. And it just makes everything so much cleaner and maintainable. And bringing on new contractors into the domain, like they can instantly get their head around and understand kind of what modules are associated with each other. And it's really nice even for testing, because if you want to test only your invoice, you can just pass that folder in, and then you're only testing everything in the invoice folder, because you know you haven't touched anything outside of that scope. Your CLI will still run the whole thing, but you're only running that scope because you're only changing what's in that scope. So there's so many benefits to doing this. And I feel like if you're in that place where you have only 10 or 12 models, there's probably not much to be gained. When you start, and that's what we're talking about here, when you start growing an application, it starts getting larger. Scoping these things makes it so much more maintainable. It's been amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll take this even a step further, even is like, you don't necessarily have to do these with things that are directly related like this. Like just because an item belongs to an invoice, you don't necessarily have to do it for, I mean, okay, the point I'm trying to make is that like you can make folders for things and organize things without things being related to each other. So for example, at Open Listings, it's like the biggest code base I've ever worked on. And we have like hundreds of files probably. And recently I was working on this feature that's like a scheduling feature, right? And very quickly things started to get like out of hand just on like a quick dirty implementation. And so like I started to break things out into their own folders, and it has made my life so much easier because, like, you know, you have schedules, so you have things like days, and then you have things like time slots. Now, you know, when those two things live as like siblings, it can get kind of convoluted because it's like, okay, I don't know. It can get kind of convoluted. And so the point is like you can put time slots sure. into days. And I realized that I am talking about things that are related in a way. But when I have also recently put things into different folders in my test files when they weren't necessarily like related. So we had a bunch of tests that relate to like an agent's schedule, right? And there are so many different use cases for how we choose our agents. And so like there's at some point it gets to the point where it becomes very unwieldy when you have tons of tests in like your models folder, for example. So it's like, you know, just create another folder in your tests/models that handles like all of these interaction specific things. It doesn't have to be like a unit test for a weekly scheduled day or like a time slot. It could just be like a folder just for like these specific things that I'm working on for like these permutations for these test cases.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the tips they had too is whatever you do, try to deploy it as consistently as you can across the code base. And it's something we didn't do at first when we were working in our code bases. So our controllers were all inherited and organized really clean like this, but then our models weren't. And it didn't make any sense to not have those map one-to-one. And so whatever you're integrating, whatever system you choose in organization, it probably makes sense to organize your models the same way, your helpers your same way, your tests the same way. Every single one of those folders will benefit from that same hierarchy structure. It's a really good approach. And this has so many benefits, not only from onboarding to clarity to just thinking about one thing at a time, but it also just encourages more objects because there's kind of more space for them. And so this whole idea that we're talking about of extracting other models and other controllers, it feels much more natural in a code base that's structured in a way that's like this. Because otherwise, it gets weird and I start hesitating. I do too as a developer, like adding the 30-second model file. It just doesn't feel right. It just feels like you're making a mess out of something. Where if it's structured and you're adding a specific interaction for an invoice item within that specific model structure and directory, it makes a ton more sense to go that way. And it just encourages really good behavior. Just thinking about things in terms of connected modules, it encourages more objects and it keeps that, honestly, that ubiquitous language structured across because the namespaces are there. That's you get to drink because I just said ubiquitous.
Yeah. Okay. So I think one way I can articulate what I'm trying to say is the example of before where they talk about like extracting the user class out. So you have things that inherit from the user that aren't like a has many belongs to relationship. So you end up having like a folder in your models class that's like user. And then you have like inside of user, you have like as signup, as profile, as admin form. Mm-hmm. So you can like break these things out into their own files. And then in your test files, you can have like a user folder, like test/model/user. And then inside of that, you'll have like as signup test, as profile test, as admin form test. And then that's like such a nice clean way because previously, how else would you have done that? It would have been like everything in the user model and then everything in user test. And then you would have all these interaction specific tests in your user test, like test signup, test profile, test admin form. And so like pretty soon you have like a 2000 line long code where if you were to collapse it and then read all of the test names, you'd be very, very soon you'd be like, oh, all these tests can go in their own file. All these tests can go in their own file. All these tests can go in their own file.
That's a great point.
And it's like, once you start breaking out your tests, oh my God, it makes your life so much easier. I was right before I had like broken out my test file for like scheduling and I like ran the test. When I ran that test file just to like at the end to make sure that I didn't break anything else, it took so long just because I was like waiting on other tests that didn't need to be ran. Now, I understand you can like throw in a regex in there and like only test certain things, but like, you know, that's not what I was doing.
Fair enough. I have a odd test specific question. So if you want to test a specific object in more of a functional test or an end-to-end test or integration test, whatever you want to call it, nobody names these things consistently. But the object is managed by two different roles or types of users and has different behaviors based on those two different roles or types of users. How do you structure those different tests? Do you put all those tests within that object's integration tests, or do you like scope those and break those out differently?
Okay, let's try to put this into an example of like WizTutor.
Perfect. So imagine our tutoring sessions controller test, which is more of an integration test. The tutoring sessions controller test has different roles against it. So you can create a tutoring session as an admin. You can create a tutoring session as a tutor. You can create a tutoring session as a student.
Okay.
And those all three have different permissions and abilities. So an admin can select any time for a tutoring session. And under the hood, they're all the same model. So where do you put those? So what I've been doing, which is a bad practice, I know this is a code smell, is I will do create, read, update, destroy as each role that can interact with it. So it'll be create as admin, create as student, create as coordinator. And then it'll be update as admin, update. And that's how I go through and do those. Or I'll break it out into like a tutoring session admin controller test, tutoring session coordinator controller test. None of that feels right to me.
I think the latter is better than the former.
Okay.
Because like those two things, like a tutor creating a tutoring session and a student creating a tutoring session, those two things are like very independent of each other. So right. Those two things can change independently. So like all of a sudden a tutoring session created by a tutor has like more functionality, like it auto confirms, for example, right?
Yeah.
So like that is way different than how a student does it. So I would have two different, it would like, maybe I have in my tests a tutoring session folder so that I know that like these are where I'm testing all the tutoring sessions. And then in that folder, I would have like an as admin test, as student test, as tutor test, and then
what's
do all of the stuff on there.
Is in you explaining that and me asking the question, it's so clear that those controllers should be split into their own controllers. Like an admin tutoring session controller, coordinator tutoring session controller, student tutoring session controller, and models. They should be split into their own models. And then the test pattern is super clear, the way forward, because it's split up the way that you're describing. You know, it's a tutoring session admin tutoring session controller, coordinator tutoring session controller. So it's a perfect example that kind of summarizes everything we just said. And so the tension I'm feeling in testing is actually objects screaming to get out. It's new models screaming to get out. And I didn't know that would be the answer when I asked the question. So it's cool to see this in practice here. Because that's models and controllers screaming to get out of that tutoring session object.
It's yeah, totally. And it sort of like follows the same pattern of like user as tutor or like user as student.
Totally.
User as admin.
Totally could. So the last thing in this chapter, because it's all about growing web applications, is taming style sheets. And I think there's actually a lot to be gained from this, but we're running out of time. But I do want to mention just a couple things. And basically, they walk through BEM and walk through, which is a kind of a discipline about CSS and how to structure your CSS. I didn't understand this world at all, and I didn't appreciate it. I just kind of used Bootstrap and then had a couple files and sometimes page specific. But I actually had a contractor come on a project, Frank Hawk, and he's a Rails developer. And he did two things. So first, he created a readme.rb within our CSS folder. And that had its own specific, this is how you handle front-end code in this project. And whether or not you put it within your CSS folder, which is, you know, debatable, or you actually put it in your project root in your README, address your front end. What I'm getting at is have a system in a project for that project and stick with the system. So whether that's using Tachyons or Bootstrap or what you're using or BEM, come up with something and use it consistently across your platform. But there was one thing that we did within this project because it was a total mess. Like there was just random CSS style sheets thrown everywhere. So one thing he did is he came in and he created a couple directories right off the bat, abstracts, base, components, and then page specific. And so abstracts within it had different CSS files, all SCSS the way we did it. So there was a sizing file, a borders file, a spacing file. And then within base, there was grid, there was colors, images, and these are their own files. And it helped so much just to have a direction and a directory for where these things should go. So if I want to create a new sizing object, it's there and in that abstracts folder within sizing. And you can even add different ones, you know, within base, you have a typography and that's where you're going to add and modify typography. And this makes things a lot more discoverable. So you, when you go to make a new version of H3, you open that typography and you see it there instead of it all being in page specific or in other places. So I guess what I'm getting at is whether you use BEM or whatever, pick a system, stick with it. And I will say that having a Hierarchy and organization within style sheets has been a game changer for a distributed team within an application like this to not step on each other's toes and just creating multiple similar classes. It's been really, really awesome having that kind of structure.
Yeah, I have so many things to say about styling. Dude, you know what my approach lately is? Is I try not to take BEM too seriously. BEM kind of is like, I think it's okay. I think the basic principles of it are good because it gives you like some foundation. But
I think you have to be pragmatic about it. I don't think you can implement it too dogmatically.
Yeah. So the way that I work on like my side projects is now I like pick a framework. So for me, it's like Materialize, which is basically like Google Material Design, but like a framework. It's like Bootstrap, but instead of using Bootstrap, it's Material. And I try to lean as hard as I can on that, which obviously if you need like super custom design, you can't do that, but at least it gives you like clean CSS, very little to none. Yeah. And on top of that, for those of you that don't know what tachyons are, hopefully you're familiar with Bootstrap because I'm about to use a Bootstrap example. If you ever use Bootstrap, and in like, I think starting since Bootstrap 5 or maybe like late versions of 4, they had these little helper classes that you could tack on. So if you like want padding 0, you put P0. If you want border 1, you put B1.
Or like hidden extra small, hidden XS. Right.
Exactly. Perfect example. Hidden XS.
Everybody,
so what tachyons is, or tachyons are, is that, but on steroids. So it's literally just tons and tons of helper classes. They have everything like you want it to float, you want it to be flex, you want it to be border one. So what I do is I use like a weird combination of tachyons and whatever framework of choice. So for me right now, it's like Material Design. And if I like want to make a, okay, so it's like the framework plus tachyons plus like componentization, because I'm very much like in the world of React. So everything to me is like components. So like if I want a button, I'll make like a button folder, and then I'll have like button specific stuff in there. And then so every time I have a button, I just do class button. But like, let's say I want like a one-off. Boom, you just throw some tachyons on there. Need a little more padding, you need it to be width 100, W-100. You need to be width 50, W-50. It's like maybe not the best way to go, but I've found it not as painful as like unwieldy CSS. So that's what I have to say about it. I don't know. It's not the best. I know that.
Yeah, I struggle with all this stuff because at the end of the day, tachyon starts to feel just like inline styles to me.
Yes. And
because it's kind of all you're doing is doing inline styles. And I get it. It's not. It's all classes. And I get that you're extending classes. But it just, it gets so complicated sometimes and not human readable that it's tough. So I agree with you to a point. But the main thing that I really agree with is start with a framework because it gives you a clean starting point to extend and build and grow from there. And probably something like a tachyons or classes that you can mix in for different types is a really good approach, whether that's componentized or what it is, whatever that direction it is you go. But I think the main thing the book was trying to get at is have a system, use your system, enforce the system, pick a camp and go with it. But when it's just like the Wild West, it's a total nightmare. And I think that's what a lot of this book is.
The last thing I'll say about tachyons is I think the creators of tachyons say that if you immediately love tachyons, there's something wrong with you. And the second thing I'll say about that is if you've never used tachyons before, it is so not readable. When you like, you look at, it's like div class equals and you have like PB0, PA0, MA1, NS, it's like what?
FLW50.
Yeah, like, what the heck am I reading? So yeah, I agree with you. It like kind of sucks, but I don't like CSS. So it is what it is.
Yeah. And I did a project recently that was using tachyons and I liked it a lot more at the end than I did at the beginning. And I'm starting to read these things and they make sense to me. So I can totally understand why people get behind it. And I like the idea of things that you can just continue to extend and mix in a way. It's not exactly a mix in. That's probably a bad use of language. Anyway, so that kind of wraps up this section. Let's jump into picks.
Yeah, my pick is like pretty silly. It's this like repository I stumbled across that I think someone like liked or tweeted or something. And it's called No Code.
Okay, let's start here. This repository has
so many stars.
23,000 stars on GitHub. So many stars. So it's like, wow, okay, this is a really popular repo. Like people are looking at this.
Like the README is like, no code. No code is the best way to write secure and reliable applications. Write nothing, deploy nowhere. And it's like getting started. And then there's like a code block that's just like empty. Like there's nothing in it. It's like building the application.
Start by writing no code. build the application. Now that you haven't done anything, time to build your application.
Yeah, it's just like deploying a Blake line. I don't know. Contributing, you don't. I thought this was like way funnier than it should have been for me.
No, it's great. Awesome pick. So my pick this week is Elasticsearch. So specifically with Bonsai, which is an Elasticsearch endpoint provider. So this is this whole world of really complex or sloppy search. I had pushed Postgres as far as it could with some of the fuzzy match and fuzzy find functions within Rails. And I really needed something that was better. So, you know, if you're searching for John Doe and you actually search for John Go, then you don't get any results. And that type of a problem is really difficult to solve and solve it well and reliably and fast. So basically, Elasticsearch integrates. I leaned on this gem called SearchKick. And this concept of Elasticsearch is this open source library that does a lot of awesome stuff under the hood that allows you to do a lot of fuzzy finders in a way that's super performant. And so in practice, I have a custom search across an application that searches all my models deep within the models, and it returns stuff so freaking fast. And it's so beautiful. Like, I get this search results page with 6 different types of models, all with their own views, and it's very performant and it's really, wow, really nice. And so, you know, if I search for a specific string and it's in a reply to someone's post, because we have like a group discussion tool, my dog's barking. Sorry about that. So like, regardless of where it's nested, it just returns it and it's super performant and it just caches everything and it works really, really well. So I couldn't recommend it.
Your dog's like, you're done. You're done. Yeah, time's up.
I think so. I love it.
Dude, that's really cool.
He's got to go to the bathroom.
All right. Should we wrap up?
Yeah, that sounds good. So thanks so much for listening. We will see you guys next week.
All right. Talk to you guys next week.